Okay, so this is the podcast on Soyinka's Death and the King's Horsemen. This is a pretty significant play, but we'll start with some biographical information about Soyinka, talk about the notion of masks, because that's going to be important for this play, and then talk about kind of the fundamental problems with this play and what Soyinka has to say about it. If you take a look at Soyinka, he's still alive. He's another Nobel Prize winner, right? Here's a guy who, like Tagore and, well, not quite like Walcott. Walcott was a product of the colonial educational system, but Soyinka and Tagore were both products of their colonial system, again, the British colonial system. But it's kind of the big colonial move is to take the best and the brightest and suck them up into the mothership, basically send them to England for further education. Senghor had kind of the same thing going on with France. And the idea was to train these people up and then send them back to be part of the colonial administration. That didn't work so well with Soyinka, as we'll see, right? He ends up going to school at the University of Leeds, a place in England, and then gives up while he's working on his master's in English and takes a job as a play reader for the Royal Court Theatre in London. And that's a really significant job because at the time, you see that's 1957, 1958 when he does this. At that time, the late 50s, there were two great spots for world theatre, right? One of them was New York, and the other was London, specifically the West End of London. And one of the big theaters there was this Royal Court Theater. So people from all over the world would send plays to some brand new plays to the Royal Court in hopes that they'd get them produced. So he reads probably 400 plays or so over those years and chooses maybe they can only mount maybe a dozen of those in 2 years. And in fact, but he has his finger on the pulse of everything that's new in theater at that time, everything that's going on that is au courant at the time. And this is going to inform his writing later on. He kind of makes his bones certainly as a playwright. I think we talked about this with Walcott, the fact that for colonial places, right, theater becomes really, really important, the most important kind of form of literature in order to create a national identity. And obviously Soyinka's is with Nigeria. So he's going to keep on working as an academic, producing plays until he becomes nationally and then internationally famous. He becomes head of the theater department in the 60s at the University of Ibadan, which is the national theater there. Writes a play and gets it produced that gets him in trouble and, in fact, sends him to jail for almost 2 years, for 22 months, because he's criticizing the political structures going on in post-independence Nigeria. Nigeria is an independent nation by this time, but it's pretty corrupt. And Soyinka is not one to pull his punches, as we'll see in this text, or at least in what he says about this text. So he spends 22 years in prison. He writes poetry, and he's even written a novel. He's not very good as a poet. He's not very good as a novelist, but he's a hell of a playwright. Right? He does great, great work there. Probably Death and the King's Horsemen is his most famous poem. In 86, he's awarded the Nobel Prize for Literature, and so becomes almost kind of untouchable by the political situation that's going on in Nigeria. Because he's so internationally famous for winning the Nobel, they can't really, although the military junta that's in place at the time wants to imprison him again, they really can't because of the kind of international pressure involved about this. If you take a look at the very last kind of comments there in 2007 and 2008, when these elections get really kind of rigged, ballot boxes get stuffed in Nigeria in 2007, Soyinka, who's been given a national award, the military junta that gets elected in place, they make the mistake of allowing Soyinka a live national audience for awarding this award. So it's going to be on TV. And he stands up there and he's supposed to be given like a $50,000 check or something like that for this award. And when he stands up and starts to talk, he says that he's donating the award to a charity. And that charity is the Supreme Court of Nigeria, because he says maybe if they had enough money, they wouldn't have had to accept the bribes that they've taken, obviously, in order to approve the results of the previous year's election. And, like, what are they going to do? Are they going to shoot him right on camera or something? No, they just pull the plug, and the entire national TV system in Nigeria goes dead in the middle of his speech, because he's dared to do this, right? This is a guy who for years was threatened to be shot on sight if he ever returned to Nigeria. And then when he does return, he's still this political gadfly. And we certainly see that in these texts as well. Now, the other page I showed you was the Egungun masks and dances. These Egungun masks, I think I referred to them a little bit earlier with Sangor, the idea that you cover the whole body so that the person wearing the mask isn't seen as a person. The person becomes a legba, a horse for the spirit, be it an ancestral spirit or the spirit of an animal or the spirit of one of the divine beings from the Yoruba, and that's the religion here, the Yoruba pantheon gets involved. Just a couple things about the cosmology that you might need to understand here and why the incidents of the play happen as they do. The first is that when we think of kind of Western monotheism, right, Judaism, Christianity, and Islam, right, we talk about the difference, right, we exist in this physical plane, and if you believe in an afterlife, there's an afterlife that you go to after this, some kind of spiritual plane that we don't know much about, but it's a one-way ticket, basically. You're in this plane, and then you die, and you move to the next plane. In the Yoruba cosmology, though, that gap between this plane and the next plane is kind of permeable. You can come back. You can come back as a spirit that inhabits one of these masks. And so people can take on the spirit of Ate, you know, the kind of creator being in Yoruba culture, or any one of the other divine beings there, or the spirit of an ancestor who has recently died. So there's this permeability. And what happens here is right, that's why the king's horseman and death is so important, why it becomes the title for this, is that, well, when the British came into Nigeria, right, there were about 400 tribes of you know, a couple thousand to tens of thousands of people each with their own king, right? The British didn't want to deal with all that. So what they told the tribespeople was, and they enforced it militarily, was you're going to elect this basically a king of kings. You're going to not elect, but you're going to choose one. We're going to appoint one king of kings, and he can have a second in command. And the deal is that you we're dealing with one person, and that's it. We're not making separate deals with 400 and some people, 400 or so tribes. We're doing this once. It's basically for the you know, the convenience of the British that this happens. Elation, the guy we're looking at here, the main character of this story, is the king's horseman. He's like the second in command. He was the chieftain of a smaller tribe, but he's literally the horseman, literally the guy who steers, who walks beside the king's horse and steers him, grabs him by the bridle or by the bit and moves the horse. So he becomes the, both ceremonially and in practice, becomes the king's most trusted advisor. And here's the deal. When the king dies, because he's so used to being guided by the horseman, he can't find his way to the next spiritual plane. What he has to do is wait in this doorway, right? His spirit waits in this doorway, and literally for the Yoruba, that doorway is behind the moon, that doorway to the next spiritual plane. And when the moon gets the closest it is to where it is when the chief or the king dies, then the king's horseman must also die so that he can guide the king's spirit to the afterlife, to the next spiritual plane. And on the day of this play we're looking at, that's the day that Elation is supposed to die to guide the king's spirit to the next spiritual plane. And Yoruba is a primitive Adam, we'd almost call it atavistic, but we'd certainly call it like We think of, say, the Santeria, Vidoux, Verdun, depending upon what Caribbean nation you're talking about or what area you're talking about. It's a religion that believes that certain things exert power in this world, not in the next world. And so Elation is through the powers that he has, able to basically put himself in a trance and will himself to death. And today's the day he's supposed to do it. Unfortunately for the continued existence of the tribe, he's not going to do it. Because, well, there's a problem there, right? And it's easy, but as Soyinka says, I think in his author's notes, that he says, it's easy to read this as just, oh, look at how the colonizers screwed everything up. But Soyinka says, that's not the point here. This isn't a clash of cultures text. This isn't about how the colonizers screwed up something that was going on well. There are two problems here. The first is, yes, the colonizers are problematic, but if they had had good leaders, the tribe themselves could have survived. The problem is that they don't have a good leader. Elation is not, as we'll see, a great leader. Yes, he's done good things, but Elation is, right, the primary character trait of a leader is you're supposed to do everything for the good of your people. Elation's far too selfish for that, and we're certainly going to see that the first time we see him, and even, in fact, the last time we see him in this play. The play is set in five separate acts. He calls them scenes here. First and third, right, he wants deliberate contrast. First and third take place in the marketplace, the big communal center, the place where women have some agency in the tribe, right? They're the ones who run at these kind of temporary stalls that are covered with fabric, made with wood, but then covered with fabric. And a lot of what they sell is fabric and stuff like that. This is kind of the heartbeat, the center of tribal commerce. The second and fourth scenes take place at the administrative building where the colonial administrators, the Pilkings, Simon and Jane, become aware of this that today's the day Elation's going to kill himself, but they don't understand these tribal traditions and customs. And so Simon eventually sets out to stop this because he's got some other big event happening, right? This play is set in World War II, and His Royal Highness, the Prince of Wales, basically number two in command after Queen Elizabeth, is making a tour of all the colonies, right? Kind of taking this brave approach, telling them to hold on and do this. So the Pilkings, the colonial administration, is going to have a masked ball, a 17th or 18th century dress masked ball, kind of British, as Jane says, therapy British style that night. And they don't want anything to ruin this. And if, for God's sake, if the chief of the people they're in charge with is going to kill himself, or the number two in command is going to kill himself, or there's going to be murder, as they misinterpret, then they need to stop that. And so it's a combination of both the colonizers sticking their nose in something they don't understand, and Elation's kind of inability to do what he's supposed to do because he's far more interested in what he wants to do. And we see that the very first time we meet him, we go through this extended sequence with him and the praise singer, basically the guy who's his hype man, if you want to call him that, right? The guy whose job it is to tell him what a great job he's doing. They come into the marketplace, and Elation acts kind of pissy there, and he's very upset. And Eolosia, the mother of the marketplace, as she's called, wonders what's wrong, right? She's kind of in charge of all the women there. She wonders what's wrong, and Elation tells her that, hey, I've been standing here for X amount of time, and you know what today is. You know what a big day this is, right? How come I don't have new clothes? How come you're not giving me, right, all the honor and literally all the physical things I deserve for what I'm doing for you? And the women of the marketplace, oh, we thought it was something that you were really upset about us, with us. Maybe it's not something really that upsetting. We can do that. Neologia, who's smarter than who's actually probably one of the smartest people in the play, realizes that, right, she's known Neologia, she's known Elation her whole life. What she thinks is, I better give this guy whatever he wants because he's just the kind of guy who might not do what he has to do to ensure the continued success of the tribe. He might not actually kill himself because he's a petulant little child, really. He might not kill himself unless we give in to him. So immediately they garb him and everything. They dress him all up. But while they're doing that, what Eliashin spots is this woman standing in the back of the group of women. In fact, she doesn't have a name. She never says a word, right? She is just an object here, which is really interesting. Eliashin starts, and you realize what a great speaker he is when he does this. He starts to kind of argue with Eolosha and the other women of the marketplace. Who's that woman over there? Well, that's, you know, that's, we call her the bride. You know what? And Eliashin offers these two arguments that show how wily a political speaker he is. He says, listen, when you go on a journey, do you pack things that you don't need? You know, if you're packing your suitcase for the weekend, do you take, oh, I don't know, your drill press or something? No, right? You only pack the things you need. You know what I'm not going to need in the next life? All this seed within me, all this sperm I got, basically. So what I need to do is leave that here. And I need to leave that in her. Well, okay, decent argument. Everybody balks a little bit. Eolosha's thinking about it. And all the women of the marketplace are urging him to turn down, urging her to turn down Eliashin about this. So Eliashin sees this kind of trepidation or this hesitation, and he says, listen, think about it. Here on the doorstep of death, I am creating new life. I'm practically dead right now because today's the day I'm going to die. So here, this child that will be born of this union will be a child of both life and death, a child that is born in the doorway, a liminal child. And this kind of mystical argument here. Eolosha relents, and we realize when we hear what the women tell her, what a big giving in this is for her. Because really, what she's, that woman that Eliashin wants to sleep with is already engaged to Eolosha's son. So when she says yes to Eliashin, yes, you can have, you know, basically you can have sex with her, she's giving away someone intended for her son. That's pretty impressive. Eolosha says, right, the women say, but, you know, you can't do this because she's betrothed to your son. She says, well, I got him that girl. I can get him another girl. Really kind of a because she knows something about Eliashin that the other women haven't realized yet, that Eliashin, if he's not appeased, may not do what he has to do. And now, given the two great arguments Eliashin uses about having sex with this woman, you would think that he would somehow ceremonialize this sex act, that it would somehow be important. But it's one of our, well, the first great indicator we get of kind of his pettiness is this demand for new clothes. This, where they actually have sex is the second big awareness we get of maybe Eliashin isn't as kind of altruistic or isn't as great a leader as everybody, well, as the praise singer and he himself say he is. Because where does he want to, does he, is he going to ceremonialize this? Is he going to take her to a special wedding bed, take her back to his place, right? Maybe light some candles, put on some Marvin Gaye, right? Make it all nice, throw rose petals around. No. What he says is, hey, listen, we're here in the middle of the marketplace. I tell you what, just throw some bolts of fabric on the ground, close one of these stands. We'll just do the Humpty Dance right here in one of these stalls. That's so demeaning. That's so tawdry. That is just so kind of obvious use of this woman, right? That it's not about all that mystical stuff he was talking about. It's not about all this great, these great argumentations. It's just about satisfying his needs right now. We see it just from this willingness that the chief himself is willing to, the only thing that's separating him from the rest of the whole tribe while he's having sex is one sheet of fabric that's draped over the top of this thing. That is just, it's just Eliashin, right, as you can see. And that ends kind of the first scene here. The second scene takes us to the Pilkings residence where they're getting ready, and we see them dressed in the Egungun mask, because this is what they're going to wear to the masked ball, right? They're not wearing these 17th or 18th century British costumes and stuff like that. They're going to wear these African, traditional African masks. And what we find out is that these masks are powerful and people respect them. Anybody who understands them respects them and doesn't mess with them, because the Egungun masks specifically are used for the handling of the dead, the most sacred thing that you do in almost any culture, the sign of almost any great civilization, is how they handle their dead. These are the masks that those who handle the dead wear. But the Pilkings are going to wear them for fun. And here's how bad they misunderstand it. That the guy who shows up to tell them about this, to tell them that this is happening with Elation, is a guy named Amusa. Now, he's a member of the tribe, but he's not of the same religion. He's, in fact, instead of Yoruba, he's a Muslim. He's the only member of the Islamic faith we see in the text. Right? He says, basically, he says, listen, I can't even look at you and give this report because you're just so far out of bounds and out of line by doing this. And the Pilkings scoff at this and say, you know, this is primitive, this is barbaric, this is pagan. And Amusa basically says, listen, I'm not even of the same religion, and I respect this. I fear this, the power behind these masks, right? But you, because you are so totally unaware of what you're doing, of how sacrilegious this is, you're willing to keep on doing this. And so we kind of get, Amusa's trying to explain to the Pilkings what's going on and what's going to happen, right? He's ready to give his report. The Pilkings misunderstand this because, of course, they don't know about the tribal traditions and customs. Otherwise, they wouldn't have had the masks on. And certainly this misinterpretation here provides incident for the rest of the play. Simon says, you know what, Amusa, you got to stop this. You can't have this. We got His Royal Highness. We got the royal court here. We got all these members of the aristocracy here visiting. This can't happen. Right? This can't, not tonight of all nights. So, well, Amusa then is charged to do that. And he's sent in basically scene three, which takes us back to the marketplace. He's sent to, back to the marketplace to do this. And we'll pick up with scene three when we pick up the second half of this Soyinka podcast.